This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and here's another podcast recommendation for you. It's called Independent Thought and Freedom with Dr. Kirk Migu. On the podcast, Kirk interviews all kinds of interesting people about their interesting and sometimes controversial ideas. You can find Independent Thought and Freedom on Apple Podcasts and pretty much every other podcast app. I encourage you to subscribe. The following episode is from Independent Thought and Freedom. I hope you enjoy it.
And machine learning fairness corrects the algorithmic unfairness and makes it adjust for reality and produces results that reflect the reality that should be, according to them, right, rather than the reality that is. So I call this a kind of algorithmic affirmative action PC policing is really what's going on. If people like Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders were really a threat to the system, they would not be getting so much publicity.
Welcome to another episode of Independent Thought and Freedom, where we have conversations with some of the most interesting people around the world who are shaking up politics, society, economies, and ideas. We've had some amazing guests on this program, including The Saker, Paul Craig Roberts, Sheikh Imran Hossein, E. Michael Jones, Cynthia McKinney, and more. If you'd like to support us to reach our next goal of actually putting together live events where we bring some of my best guests side by side on one stage, please consider becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll find the link below. Also, if you are an author or researcher with important ideas to share with the world and want to have a greater impact, I am offering a free masterclass, 3 steps on how to leverage your intellectual authority to become a media personality. The link for that class is in the description as well. And now, on to this week's show. Welcome to Independent Thought and Freedom. The internet has changed. When it started, it explicitly had the values of libertarianism and free thinking. It was dedicated to the free flow of information. Then something happened. The internet is now a place of surveillance, of thought police, of censorship, of conformity. How and why did this change occur? I'm pleased to have today my friend, Michael Rechtenwald, author of a new book called The Google Archipelago, The Digital Gulag, and the Simulation of Freedom. Welcome back, Michael.
Hi, Kirk. Thanks for having me.
Good. So how's your book promotion going?
It's going pretty well. I'm getting a lot of press and had a big story in the Epoch Times and actually 2 or 3 stories in the Epoch Times, and some other media. So it's doing well, but could always do better. So
yeah,
if your viewers want to know what's going on in terms of big digital, as I call it, and what the politics are and why, I think the book does a good job explaining it.
Yeah. I mean, you've given some great interviews already. You know, I've taken a look at a couple of them. And has anything surprised you during this promotional tour? Because I see one, you know, some interviewers are genuinely surprised at the insights, you know, you've generated in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had people just say that the book blew their mind or shook them to the core.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
It's also elicited the Google whistleblower, Zach Voorhees, has contacted me, and we're going to be working on a project soon to further expose Google and what they're about. Google Archipelago is definitely out there, and I think it's a required reading for understanding all this, but I'm going to go further with it too.
Well, that's excellent. Let's start off, I mean, with the origins of the book. Even I would say it's very much connected to your backstory at NYU. Yeah. When you're a professor there, and then even your political transition. You were on before about 9 months ago, episode 5. I urge everybody to check it out. It was a great interview. But let's fill people in who maybe haven't seen that. So just tell me about, you know, the backstory, NYU, and your political transition. Sure. That sort of led to all of this.
Sure. In the fall of 2016, I started a Twitter account called Anti-PC NYU Prof. And handle became sort of infamous very quickly. I got attention from an NYU student newspaper reporter, and I did an interview for the newspaper, the Washington Square News. And after that interview ran, I actually revealed myself as the person behind this Twitter handle, mm-hmm. Anti-PC NYU Prof. Then within 48 hours, all hell broke loose. I was quickly and roundly condemned by colleagues, a committee calling themselves the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Group. They roundly condemned me for my views. All I had done was criticized bias reporting hotlines, no platforming of speakers, safe spaces, and trigger warnings. And for that, just for that, I was condemned, called morally reprobate and things like that. And then also within 48 hours of that interview appearing, I was put on a paid leave of absence.
Right.
And the suggestion was that I needed it for my mental health. And they sort of suggested it, I must be crazy for criticizing social justice and the university policies and so forth.
Yeah.
And then the story was picked up real quickly by the New York Post. And after that, it just went viral.
Right.
And the rest is history. You can go to michaelrechtenwald.com and go to the media page there, and you'll see all the news that has ensued.
So it's kind of like a combination of digital, the implications of your digital activities in your career, your professional life, and so forth. Now, you were a communist first, right? Were you a member of the Communist Party?
I was at the time that I came out and critiqued social justice, I was a left communist, member of a group called Insurgent Notes, and a writer for them, and also other websites and other periodicals publishing socialist screeds, if you will.
Yeah.
And analysis from a Marxist perspective. I mean, in the academy, you've got to be some sort of leftist or other.
Yeah.
Marxism seemed to be the best one for me.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't be a queer theorist or something like that. But after that Twitter escapade and the sort of vitriolic response that I received, and then after this thing went viral, I mean, I was attacked on by thousands of leftists. I was ejected from that communist group. They basically held like a cyber trial in which they, you know, put me up for charges of various sorts, for example, appearing on Fox News and other sorts of violations, I guess.
Right.
Basically, I was, you know, basically given a cyber show trial, in effect, and ejected, and then attacked by thousands and thousands of leftists online and off. I was, when I came back from the leave of absence, I was shunned by my entire faculty in my department, over 100 faculty members. Then towards the end of that first semester back, I was attacked in a series of blistering emails in which they called me everything from alt-right to Satan to short pants white devil,
right,
and fragile white male. All kinds of racist and sexist epithets they hurled at me while calling me a sexist and a racist.
Yeah. So,
which is exactly what the left does, you know.
Yeah.
They project quite a bit. And I don't know if it's unconscious or what.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of times, you know, anti-political correctness, you know, comes from the right mainly.
Right.
But it's interesting that when you started it and you started that Twitter handle, you said you were a left communist.
So yeah.
Could you kind of just elaborate that a bit? Because, you know, most people say, oh, it's all these, you know, racist alt-right people that critique political correctness. But you were coming from the left.
Yeah, that's right. I thought, first of all, I've always been a critic of identity politics.
Yeah.
And I find it to be a regressive sort of leftism. And I've always criticized it for being a blind alley and a way of dividing up the left and putting people into various identity categories and splintering them off into endless, division, and also then putting them into competition with each other for the most subordinated trophy in in the oppression Olympics. But when I came out against social justice, everybody attacked me.
Yeah.
Communists, people that had been my friends, I had a lot of communist friends. Every one of them had, in the end, finally rejected me.
Yeah.
Wow. And the left showed me like they were very much consolidated and circling the wagons, you know, with the resistance of Trump. And anybody that sounded even remotely like they were coming from the other side was had to be condemned and had to be ejected and attacked, because if you didn't attack them, then maybe you were one of them as well. So this is how they work in a pack and attack mobs.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what, I'm out of here. I don't want anything to do with the left anymore at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And I basically resigned. I sent in my leftist badges back to the headquarters. And I basically said, I'm out, you know, forget it.
Yeah.
I don't want anything to do with this anymore. Then, you know, I just started developing a whole different politics. And I just started to reject, you know, mass politics basically altogether.
Right.
And developed into a sort of civil and cultural libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
And since have been an invited speaker by the Mises Institute to speak to, you know, major conferences as they're basically one of their lead speakers talking about social justice and how it conflicts with civil and cultural libertarianism.
Yeah.
I've veered towards economic libertarianism too.
Mm-hmm.
So It's been quite a journey.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ideologically interesting stuff and theoretically interesting stuff you brought there. But let's reapproach it by going through your book, because I think your book is very important, and it touches on all these things. Because I said your personal story, you know, is very
I should mention that I wrote another book before this called Springtime for Snowflakes,
right,
which documents my whole movement and political transmutation, and also then goes into the deep history of what I see as the roots of this new social justice creed in postmodern theory and Soviet and Sino-communist theory as well and practice. Yeah. So, you know, Springtime for Snowflakes is that story.
Yeah.
But we can then go into Google Archipelago, sure.
Yeah, because it's extremely relevant, and it's also personally relevant to me. I mean, I've just been permanently banned from a Facebook ad account, so I can't do any posting or paid boosting. I've been banned several times on Facebook, 30-day bans and all that. And my YouTube channel, I was banned for a while, and then it was lifted, and I'm definitely shadow banned. And so all this stuff is definitely going on. So the Google Archipelago, let's look at the outline and the implications. Yeah. So what's the argument you're laying out here?
Well, let's start with the title. It's always a good place to start.
Yeah.
My titles have been basically little bombs, you know?
Yeah. It's a brilliant title.
Oh, thank you. So it's an obvious play on Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is that, like the Soviet Gulag system, the Google Archipelago, for which Google stands as an emblem for all of big digital, Google Archipelago is a kind of digital gulagging that I see being, you know, intensified, expanded, and basically metastasizing more and more broadly and penetrating more and more deeply by the day, or by the minute, really. So what happened in the Gulag system that's like what's going on in the digital Gulag of the Google Archipelago? Mm-hmm. People are being disappeared, just as they were in the Soviet Union, disappeared and sent into camps. Just as in the Google Archipelago, people are being erased, deleted, digitally disappeared.
Yeah.
People's ideology is being surveilled, just as it was in the Soviet Union. If you said something that was wrong or something that disagreed with the party line or anything like that, you could be either shot or sent to the Gulag. Similarly, today, just as you've mentioned in your own case, if you have a perspective that's not approved of by the leftist authoritarians that are running the internet, then the same thing will happen to you in a digital way.
Mm-hmm.
You're being digitally surveilled upon, your opinions are being monitored. You're being deplatformed in different places and also basically erased in the end for some people. For example, you saw the four major so-called alt-right or right-wing people that were deplatformed from Facebook. Milo Yiannopoulos, Alex Jones, Laura Loomer, and one other.
Farrakhan.
Who was it?
Farrakhan.
Oh, Farrakhan. Yeah. They put him in the same bundle with Farrakhan, which I thought was a real slap in the face.
Yeah.
To them, because there isn't a racist, sexist, or homophobe or alt-right person among these people, yet they were accused of hate.
Yeah,
of being leaders of a hate of organization.
Yeah, Farrakhan is not alt-right in any way, shape, or form.
No, he's not alt-right, but he is the leader of a hate group, right? In his case, you know, he is very, very much an anti-Semite. But these other people have not exhibited anything to that extent.
Yeah, and in fact, Laura Loomer, and well, I don't know about the case of Milo. Sometimes he says yes, sometimes no.
Well, but Milo is just a joker. I mean, he's a comedian, you know?
Yeah.
A comedian who's been silenced and, as you see, digitally erased and disappeared.
But Laura Loomer is Jewish. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right.
Milo has said he is, but I'm not exactly sure about
it. Right, I'm not sure about that either.
Yeah.
But he's definitely gay, and he's married to a black man.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he's, you know, certainly can't be a homophobic. And if he's racist, he's a strange one.
Yeah.
Which he's always joked about. He says he's been called racist, sexist, misogynist, anti-Semitic, and so forth, and Islamophobic. And he'll say, jokingly, the only one true is Islamophobic.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what to make of that. It's just
yeah. I know it. But so the thing is that so we have this phenomenon here, and what you're doing is not only talking about internet censorship.
That's right.
But you're also talking about you're kind of taking the postmodern, a kind of Baudrillardian idea about simulation.
That's right.
And the simulation.
I take the notion of the simulacrum of Jean Baudrillard, whose book Simulations was about how basically postmodern life was like a production of simulations, right?
Yeah.
And that we're not living in the quote-unquote real anymore.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm arguing in the book that the digital giants are producing or attempting to produce similarly a simulation, which they then try to fob off on us as reality.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that, you know, forget about fake news. That's minor compared to fake reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fake reality is what's trying to be pawned off on us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a fake news. It's a fake reality about which fake news is then generated.
Yeah.
And I talk about this in the book's conclusion and in connection with this organization known as New Knowledge, which is really new nescience, new non-knowledge, new idiocy, new insanity. And I'll leave it open to let the reader look into that.
All right.
Get into everything I say there, but it's basically the idea is that the digital giants are together producing a digital simulacrum and then suggesting that anyone who differs from it or differs with it is a hate.
Yeah.
Basically engaged in hate or something.
Or in your case, mentally disturbed, right?
Mentally disturbed, that's right.
Which is the same thing like the Cultural Revolution, Mao Zedong, you know, and then you have to make your public apologies for,
right.
Oh, I am so sorry for going against the party line or, you know.
Yes. We're living in a soft cultural revolution right now. And this is very much the same sorts of things. All the four olds are being taken down and the everything to do with historical memory, cultural legacies, all of these things are under attack. Western culture is deemed evil, and you know, white supremacists and misogynists and every other possible thing you can think of. The book also is arguing that there's a new kind of dominant ideology and politics that are underway, and it's called corporate socialism.
Right.
And what I mean by corporate socialism is what is socialism if not monopolization, right?
Yeah.
Monopolization of the means of production and also of the state and also of the ideological apparatuses by a singular state. A party-run state. Today, what we see is a kind of corporate socialism in which these giant corporate monopolists attempt to produce what I call a two-tiered system in which there's the monopolies on the top and actually existing socialism for everybody else.
Right, right.
This is what the object is. This is why I argue that people Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders were really a threat to the system, they would not be getting so much publicity.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So yeah. They aren't. I think they're actually unwitting dupes, spreading an ideological socialism on the ground so that the population begins to worry about only equality amongst this second tier.
Correct, correct.
That's the only thing that matters, while actually reducing the expectations of everyone within that sphere. As long as it's equal, they think everything's fine, despite the fact that there's monopolization of everything by these corporate giants. And as long as these corporate giants are spitting back to these people the rhetoric that they want to hear, the woke capitalist rhetoric, making them feel better about themselves and the world at large because their values are being reflected back to them. As long as that's going on, they're not even noticing the overall structure of what's happening.
Yeah, because I think it ties into your critique when you were a left communist. And I know, especially on the IMN network, which I'm newly on, and this is being broadcast on, it's a lot of left-wing people, Green Party, and there might be a lot of libertarian socialists listening, yeah. Which is very different from state socialism, which is what I think you're referring to.
That's right. I was a libertarian socialist.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
People say that's a contradiction, but not within socialism. I mean, there's this division and this actual position, which is justifiable within socialist thought. Yeah.
Like Emma Goldman and it goes to that branch of socialism.
Right.
Even the Spanish Revolution.
But I would argue with them now is that I thought that such a socialism could elude the statism of what came of the Soviet Union and China and so on and so forth. But I don't believe that anymore. I don't think it can elude that statism. It definitely depends upon it. And it really can't, there is no withering away of the state. In fact, it has to actually become fortified and extended and magnified. And it can't ever wither away to maintain socialism. Socialism has to be maintained by force.
Right, right. I know. When you were talking about as a left communist, were anti-PC and against identity politics. I think I've heard other progressives, justify it from their perspective, and I think it might have been Brendan O'Neill from Spiked, or it could be someone else. And you talk about, you can talk about every single identity except class, right? So
right,
basically
right.
That's so you're leaving, so people worship Steve Jobs and Apple,
right? It's really ridiculous. I mean, but it's interesting because the same sort of contradiction I would argue actually exists within socialism, state socialism, and that is, again, there's this failure to notice that you have the dictatorship is not of the proletariat. The dictatorship is always of the state leaders, and in the case of the Soviet Union and China, it's the party which dictates everything, and which has its own elite, which is an elite, which is a ruling class, which is an exploitative class, which is all of the things that socialism is supposed to eradicate,
right.
But never can or never does, and in fact, strangely intensifies. Because what happened in the Soviet Union with the Gulag system, it was a system of forced slave labor.
Yeah.
Slave labor. Slavery. No money. No
That's
money.
Right.
No wages. Okay? So, not wage slavery, but real slavery. It's just unbelievable that the left has gotten away with so much criminality and has been unbelievably not called out for it, and still works itself and manages to parade itself around as the default no-fault ideology.
Yeah. Yeah, Yeah. And, you know, you talk about leftist authoritarianism a lot. You want to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, sure. It's a kind of dictatorial leftism, which is enforced by virtue of first of all, leftism, when it's it tends towards authoritarianism. But anyway, what I mean by left authoritarianism is there's this notion that there's no question of being right. There's no question about the idea that the left is right, that their views are absolutely correct. There's no doubt about them, and anybody who disagrees must be a monster. Yeah. And so then it's enforced as if it's correct, and then it's necessarily authoritarian at that point.
Yeah.
Because it takes upon itself, it arrogates to itself this authority to enforce its values above it. You can see it with Antifa.
Yeah.
Which I think should be pronounced Antifa, but whatever.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
With your Aunt Tifa, you can see the authoritarianism there. They imagine themselves to be anti-fascist, but they're much closer to fascism than the people they object to.
Yeah.
Because...
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, and we see this leftist authoritarianism in Google. Like for instance, my bands... all the time, right? You have no recourse, you have no rights, you have to guess at what policy you violated, right?
Exactly.
They won't tell you, right? I've shot back at them and I said, you know, this is Kafkaesque. I mean, you know, this is insane. What kind of, you know, what you, this $1 billion company, what type of kangaroo court are you running here?
Let's talk about the issue of what they're calling algorithmic unfairness.
Right.
For example, and how, what this is and what they're trying to do and then what they do to rectify it. Okay, algorithmic unfairness in their term is really the way algorithms would give results that would be unfair from their standpoint, according to their ethos.
Right.
That is, if you searched, for example, for American CEOs and it gives you back a disproportionate number of men as the CEOs of corporations, even if that's the fair sampling of reality.
White men on top of that, yeah.
What's that?
White men on top of that, even worse.
They're calling with machine learning fairness, and machine learning fairness corrects the algorithmic unfairness and makes it adjusts for reality and produces results that reflect the reality that should be, according to them, rather than the reality that is. So I call this a kind of algorithmic affirmative action PC policing is really what's going on.
Yeah.
And they're doing this on and on. So
It's really like creating a simulated reality, like what you're talking
about. Exactly right. It's a simulation that they're trying to produce. And they say that they intervene, and this was revealed in the documents that were exposed by Zach Voorhees and Project Veritas, and they show that they admit straight up that they are trying to make a better world according to their values, and they have no bones about actually producing results that are more like the world as it should be, according to them, than the world as it is.
Yeah, and it's like the movie The Matrix, the precursor that Agent Smith was telling what's his name, Neo, because he was saying how, you know, so it's like now they're building this Matrix world, and I remember Agent Smith telling Neo that we built a perfect world for you guys, but you hated it, so we had to build this this imperfect world. But right now these idiots are in the process of building their so-called perfect world.
They're trying to produce a matrix that is perfect according to their values.
That's right.
And then they're trying to shove it down our throats as reality, and if we reject it, we're disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, they have blacklists, you know.
Yeah.
They have blacklists where they blacklist certain sites from showing up in news feeds.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also relegated, you know, there's a ranking system for search results that are supposed to be based on certain criteria that are fixed and effectively neutral. How many sites link to it? how many hits does it get, et cetera, et cetera. This is the ranking. Well, they have altered that ranking using superimposed algorithmic adjustments. Yeah. First of all, they have blacklists that delete certain websites from ever showing up. They have fake news sorting, which is disproportionately by a long shot biased against right-leaning or non-leftist sites, and on and on and on. They just, and YouTube, for example, has similar adjustments they make.
Yeah, because even if you type in my name and the title of the podcast, my podcast won't show up. But mirrors and other things, so thankfully, this is going to be on the IMN network instead of my own channel. But if my own channel with my name, the title of this podcast, my podcast will show up, but the mirrors will. It's amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's bizarre. Yeah. I mean, it's really because you've been they're trying to digitally erase you and treat you as fake news.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're not even purveying news, you're purveying editorial content.
That's right. That's right.
They don't care. For example, YouTube, when a Slate reporter went on to YouTube and tried to find videos about abortion, the predominant top videos were anti-abortion or pro-life. This reporter complained to YouTube, i.e. Alphabet, i.e. Google. And within a weekend, this was rectified by virtue of putting that search on a particular file that adjusts for the search results, such that pro-life or anti-abortion searches were now debunked and put much lower in the search, and the top 10 now are pro-abortion.
Are you familiar with the story of Tay AI and some of the Google, the artificial intelligence bot they had on Twitter?
I don't know about that, actually.
So they had this experiment, I think like 2012, 2014, something like that. And on Twitter, where they had this bot that was going to learn by interacting with people, and supposed to be like, one of the definitions people had of artificial intelligence is that if you had a conversation and you couldn't tell if it was a real person.
Yeah, right. The Turing test. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So it was going to be something like that. And what this computer came back with, I don't know if a lot of 4chan trolls were like screwing around with it, but coming up with stuff that, they were, saying we're racist, and then they had to just shut the thing down in 24 hours. They got this bot to spew things that were just totally, anti-PC, and in the hip language of the alt-right and stuff.
It's, oh my God.
Actually quite funny. Very,
and, that's hilarious. So it started learning. It started learning the language and the vocabulary and the perspective of the enemy for Google.
That's right.
And
the same thing happened with Google image search. The images were bringing up politically incorrect things with different searches, and so they kind of realized, well, we can't let it learn naturally, because as you're saying, the natural world is unjust.
It's unjust. They can't have the natural world reflected in their results. They cannot have it. It has to be changed, and it has to be changed according to their criteria, because they are necessarily right, because they're authoritarian, PC authoritarians, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Now, there are so many dimensions to this that I tried to get a container big enough that effectively stands for everything, but there's no way I could delineate every last thing.
Exactly.
It's too much. I couldn't do it. It was so overwhelming writing this book, because it's a bottomless pit.
Yeah. I mean, which is why, you have to continue it in series after series.
Yes, we're going to go on with this, and the next book is going to be more like a complete catalog plus analysis of everything they're doing.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, because I mean, and there's a couple, And as you said in the preface to your book, unlike some of your earlier books where you're talking about the 19th century, the subject matter is still.
And it's basically fixed. It's not going to change, right?
Yeah. Whereas while you're writing it, things are changing, you know?
Constantly. So, like, for example, things happened after I was luckily, the Project Veritas expose came just while I was in the middle of writing this.
Yeah.
And I was able to include that, and it just validated everything I was arguing. Thank goodness, because, you know, how I'm still getting people saying that I'm an anti-left-wing conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
No. I'm still being attacked by the left.
Yeah.
In particular on Amazon, in the reviews for this book. So if you do get the book and you're not a leftist, please do review it on Amazon.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, of course, Amazon is tilted in the same way, and they're Google's partner. I mean, for example, I mean, if you type in the letter A in a Google search, the first, before you even fill it out, you get a completion of the word to Amazon. So why is that? I mean, there's certainly more things that are begin with the letter A than Amazon, but it is the first thing that's auto-filled by the Google algorithms.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And what's amazing is that, there was a recent Economist article and Andrew Yang has been on this campaign too, that, about big data. And and data is now more valuable than oil, right? So these companies that harvest our data, they are now the richest companies, in the world. Yeah. They are more valuable than the oil companies, Google.
And the means by which they have acquired the data is dubious. Despite all the disclaimers and agreements that you signed to go on different social media platforms, there's still something surreptitious about the way that data is collected.
Yeah. And the way it's used and whose property it is.
Property it is, my own data about me is not my property, And I thought, something was up when Google started with Google Books. I thought, this is great. I can now look at these 19th century texts without going to England, where I was having to go. Excuse me, the United Kingdom. Sorry. we must erase the word England from.
Well, with Scotland going and maybe Northern Ireland, who knows?
So, with the, I thought, this is great. But on the other hand, I thought, but who owns this? And they were putting their name on everything,
Yeah.
And then it's scary because now you have digital text, dominating, and then question about the originals underneath becomes an issue.
Yeah.
Whether they're there, whether they have been digitally changed is a question, I think, and whether, in fact, there is a ton of digital... there's a digital bias as to what gets sized in the first place. So we're getting, again, that world reflected to us that as the Google archipelago principles would have it.
Yeah, it's really amazing because I mean I'm
sorry. All right. I don't know. I can't figure out how to get this off. Sorry about that.
Yeah, you know, you're old enough, obviously, to remember when the internet started, and it was a libertarian space.
That's right.
The whole ethos was cyberpunk kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Anti.
John Perry Barlow was one of the main, theorists, or you know, of the internet and what it was supposed to be. This free, you know, non. Propertarian and totally libertarian, free expression, peer-to-peer economics, it would overcome.
That's what it was, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I remember, I mean, when it first started out, it was amazing. It just opened up a whole world of information that had been suppressed, and I was learning about things that, while I was living through it, was hidden from me, you know?
Yes.
You know, it was just amazing, and it's this transformation is incredible.
It's the same parallel. It's parallel to the transformation that happened, as I argue in the book, in the Soviet Union.
Correct.
You know, had the exact same propagandistic way that you referred to what was going to take place. This communitarian, decentralized, workers-owned, egalitarian space, which becomes a centralized dictatorial monopolistic.
Yeah, it's kind of like Animal Farm, which parodies that very thing.
Yes, Animal Farm is exactly like this, and of course, 1984.
Oh yeah.
Everything is, you know, everything is inverted, just as in the language, you know, war is peace. Truth is falsity. Falsity is truth. Just incredible what's going on.
And, you know, what's been happening recently, and I think that, because I remember when you were, you had the original idea for the book and you were developing it, last year. But I think what's happened in the past year is that there's been a rise of progressives, right? Because this show now is being, mostly the viewers are like progressives on the left.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, right? And I'm trying to break.
Well, they call themselves progressive. I'd call them regressive, but right. Yeah.
No, but there's a different sort. Like what I mean is like Tulsi Gabbard. What I mean
Is
like, you know what I mean? Like, not the Hillary progressives, right?
Right. More like the Bernie type progressives.
Yeah.
Not the authoritarian types. Identitarian types. Yeah.
And they are also being censored by, you know, Google censored tools.
That's true. That is true. There is, and this may be one blind spot in the book, which I'm focusing most about how the left, the authoritarian leftism of Google and the whole big digital archipelago is anti-right, but they are also discriminatory against a certain very small sliver of leftism.
But I mean, I think you could be forgiven for that, because that's the point I'm trying to make. Like a year ago when you were starting it and writing it, that didn't happen yet.
Yeah, it hadn't happened yet. Yeah, no. They've started it now.
Yeah.
And I did say that when I looked at the treasure trove of 100 pages of documentation that Zach Voorhees exposed, does list certain progressive sites as also being delisted and blacklisted by Google.
Yeah.
So that is true.
Yeah, like Rania Kalik from, I can't remember what her thing, what her site is called, but I know she has a lot of videos like, you know, anti-US intervention in
yes, that stuff is being squashed. I mean, look at the left now,
and the BDS
power, the left in power. They're not. Yeah. They're interventionists. They're war hawks. They're hawks. They're hawkish, and they're regime change fanatics.
Yeah,
it's everything that they were supposedly opposed to. They're against now. I mean, it's of course partly due to this Trump derangement syndrome.
Absolutely,
That's Trump, they have to oppose no matter what it is.
You know? That's right.
Trump could be a socialist tomorrow, and they would then oppose socialism.
That's right. No, exactly. But that's exactly it. The arbitrariness of the ideology, I think, is central. It's central. Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, again, like, say within the past year from when you started, I mean, certainly I only recently discovered him, is Jimmy Dore, the comedian. And I love him. I'm like addicted to his channel and his videos. He's hilarious. And he calls out the Democratic Party and all the hypocrisy. But he's like totally on the left, right? Like progressive, like anti-war, anti-cap, anti-corporate. And he is being blocked by Facebook. He's being demonetized.
Right? See, I regret that I didn't. I think that I probably would be less prone to be called ideologically biased if I had included things like that, but like you said, it really wasn't apparent yet.
No, it wasn't happening at the time, and now we see it's like, you know, it's expanding and it's like eating itself. And a lot of the people who may have been cheering on the deplatforming of Milo or might be regretting it now.
They are. I said that the Overton window will come down on the very necks of those who are closing it on others.
Yeah.
Because they're sooner or later, their speech will be unacceptable as well.
Exactly. You know,
and this is what they don't get. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. But.
Yeah. And it's really just, you know, the old, I can't remember what the whole thing was, but first they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist. And then
isn't it funny though, that the left seems so bent on curtailing freedom of speech or free speech. For example, they do everything to talk about how limited, for example, in the U.S., the First Amendment really is supposed, it really just limits to, it really just means that the government cannot encroach upon you.
Exactly.
That's not true.
Exactly.
That's not true. It actually is the government must protect your speech.
That's right.
It isn't just about non-encroachment. It's incumbent upon the state to protect the speech of people, even when they're unpopular, or especially when they are.
Isn't it amazing that the left, and I think it's best to call them the liberal left, because
I call them anti-liberal left.
you're right. You're right, because
what you're saying. They came from liberalism, but they're not liberals anymore. That's their provenance is the liberal class.
Yeah.
But they're really anti-liberal or illiberal.
Like what's that? Phil Oakes. You know Phil Oakes' song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal? You know that song?
Yeah. Very, very funny.
Yeah. And it's those people I'm talking about. Like
I know. It's the liberals who leftists or socialists have hated forever.
That's right.
As more dangerous and pernicious than the right. And I always said that too.
Yeah,
I always said that as a communist, that they were really worse.
That's
because they're hypocrites. For one, they're hypocrites, and you know they are disguising their domination under the cloak of egalitarianism and under the cloak of under the cloak of a fake progressivism. You know.
Yeah. Of niceness and all this stuff. Yeah. You know, and caring and when really they're nothing of the kind, you know, and so I think that, so while this kind of it's a small sliver, as you say, this anti-war, anti-corporate progressives, which they identify, you know, because when I'm listening to Jimmy Dore and his people and their perspective, and it's interesting because, I mean, so they're calling like Hillary Clinton and you know that what you'd be calling left and liberal left, or maybe you wouldn't call her liberal, but what the mainstream would call liberal left, and so they are calling them right wing, so they're saying Hillary is really a right wing conservative, and the Democratic Party, all these people, Biden and Warren and all these people, are just right-wing neocon conservatives. And so there's a real difficulty of the terminology with what's going on today. And it's an issue I've been sort of exploring with Cynthia McKinney, with the same IMN network people, this whole left and right. And I'm not sure what the right, I think we have to discover the right terminology for it.
Because, yes.
Yeah.
I've been calling them the illiberal left.
Yeah.
I think that the main movement today is corporate socialism.
That's right. You see, that there is so important. Because even when you look at Jimmy Dore and these guys, right, and they're saying all this is right wing, and they will not say, so you see, the corporate thing is key. I think that is key. So you have anti-corporate people on the right, and people on the left don't understand that.
They don't get that either. They don't get it. Because the right, the anti-corporatists on the right, they see corporations as leftists in general because they're a collectivist, you know, altogether. Right. It's a kind of collectivism which is to the right is a left phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
It's not about individuals. It's about this kind of a colluding of a kind of, and I'm going to use the word. I don't care if I'll. Cabal.
Yeah.
I know that's a verboten term now from the illiberal PC authoritarian. Yeah. You can't use the word cabal or you're a racist. I'm sorry, anti-Semite. No, it's what it is. These are, they're, you know, they see it as a cabal of collectivists who use a corporatist collectivist power to dominate, and then also, of course, to dominate the state and get certain favors from the state and then use the state in their favor. They bolster the state,
right?
And they use state power that they've bolstered in order to continue to bolster their position.
Because
so it's a hand in glove sort of situation.
Crony capitalism is hardly different.
Crony capitalism
is hardly different from state socialism. Right?
It's very similar.
Yeah.
It's the same. It's just who is in charge.
That's right.
I mean, Anthony Sutton put this so well in his book about the Russian Revolution. He said that basically corporate socialists and state socialists differ only in the people who are wielding the power.
Exactly.
It's the same setup. It's just a different group.
That's right.
You know, and he shows how, in fact, the Soviet Union, the revolution and the early Soviet Union was funded by these corporate monopolists.
That's right. Because a lot of the bankers in New York funded
They funded the Bolsheviks. This is so little known. They funded the Bolsheviks. Why? They wanted monopolies. They also, first of all, it was a way to eliminate potential competitors.
Yeah.
Because little known to most people was the Soviet Union was undergoing, or what became the Soviet Union, was undergoing a kind of industrial revolution. And it was emerging with potential competitors to Western and US based corporate industrialism and industrialists and bankers. So they attempted to establish monopolies in the Soviet Union, and they did over a lot of things, over natural resources to a great extent. So, I mean, all this is very little known. And also there's this, and this I want to get out there. There's this stupid idea that that there's no way that corporations can be leftist. This is a myth that has to be exploded once and for all. This is not true.
Yeah,
I think what
ties people up is the terminology, because
it's terminology.
But
they're using leftist ideology.
That's right.
To promote their agenda.
That's
and, for example, there was corporate socialism in the U.S. back at the turn of the century, of the 19th to the 20th century. King Camp Gillette was one of the main propounders of this. And he talked about achieving socialism through incorporation, through the monopolization of all production by a corporation, which would become the state and the producer. What is that like? What does that sound like? Huh?
Exactly.
They own all production and they control the state. Wow, what does that sound familiar to? It sounds familiar to the Soviet Union and China.
You know what I think? What might be a better term that could unite the dissident right and the dissident left? Something like collectivist authoritarianism.
Yeah, that could be right. Collectivism is the key. Collectivism and authoritarianism.
And authoritarian together. Because there's a type of collectivism that the left, that could be free, which is like a left socialism. So
could be.
You know?
Theoretically, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. It's theoretical. But so they're wedded to the idea. And I understand that because when I was younger, I was very much on that side of the left.
I mean, even today, to this point, even so-called anti-Soviet communists, like who call, you know, anybody that was a Stalinist a tanky and all that.
Yeah.
Even they apologize for the criminality of the Soviet Union.
And yes.
They deny all of the criminality, the horrendous casualties of the famines, you know, state-induced famines, and political imprisonment and and murder, and on and on and on. I mean, they deny the numbers. They make specious comparisons to you know, colonialism, as if colonialism is tied to anything, any system at all. It's not. It's just.
Yeah,
you know, colonialism isn't necessarily tied to any system, and as you saw, the Soviet Union was colonialist as well.
Yeah,
that's where they got the term tankies from, because they took their tanks and they rolled them into Czechoslovakia and they took over through force.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing particularly colonialist necessarily about capitalism or socialism. It depends on what they actually do. And it's so frustrating that even the so-called, even amongst the libertarian left, they oftentimes apologize for and deny and try to deflect and also
the crimes of communism and so forth.
Yeah, they're very much trying to cover for and
because they feel it will undermine their own commitment to.
That's right. I mean, that it would undermine their own commitments, and it would go along with the right argument that, in fact, you know, every time socialism has been adopted anywhere, anytime, any country,
I think it's one of the distortions of tribalist thinking. So that, you know,
that's right. These are your tribesmen, so you can't condemn them. That's right.
And you know, in looking at the parallels of the New York bankers funding the Bolsheviks, it's like George Soros funding Antifa.
He's funding Antifa. He's funding all kinds
rebellion.
Of.
Yeah. Wall Street is funding Extinction Rebellion, right? So
yes,
the whole climate change thing is being funded by all these bankers because they want the carbon tax.
The carbon tax, and they want control over the population.
That's right, you know. And so on the one hand, you have that, how crony capitalism and state socialism are virtually indistinguishable.
Yes.
And then, you know, so you also, you know, you're speaking at places like the von Mises Institute and stuff like that.
Yes.
Again, a lot of people on the left don't necessarily understand. But
they don't get it.
That vision of capitalism that the von Mises Institute has, which is people, you know, being free, having their own property, not being dominated by the state, anti-war,
and being anti-monopolists, you know.
That's right.
Anti-state supported monopolies, and, you know, anti-ingratiation of the state and vice versa by these corporate giants.
And again, the sort of ideal of those radical individualist capitalists and leftist socialists are hardly any different. I mean,
it's very difficult to distinguish. There's only one thing I think that really distinguishes them, and that is the belief that property is necessary for individual rights.
That's right.
And I actually hold that view now. I don't think that there is any way to guarantee rights without property, at least because if nothing else, everybody has the property of their own person.
Yeah.
And without that, there's no telling what could happen.
Yeah,
and without individual rights, you can roll over people with collectivism and say it's all for the good of the whole. Meanwhile, half the whole is half the whole is killed.
That's right. You
know, it's a French Revolutionary conundrum of, you know, chopping off heads till there's none left. That's now right. You have your perfect state, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, because when I was on the left too, I always thought, you know, like Proudhon, property is theft, property is oppression. It's a capitalist of the property that oppress the working class, and I could not understand the right wing idea that property was freedom.
It's really, and then you're taught as a leftist, you're taught that any argument with this is just an ideology being spread by capitalists, and anybody that believes this is just duped by capitalist ideological indoctrination, which is not true. Especially in my case, I didn't come to this through capitalist ideology. Right. I came to it through my own thinking and my own discovery and my own development, you know, and the development of my thought. It's not like I came to this because somebody was paying me. I'm not getting paid to say any of this.
That's right. And now, when I came to Trinidad and became politically involved and so forth, and the political party we were forming, which is an independent thing and fighting against all the elites. Now, we were to be funded by a business that we were creating, and that was with the brainchild of my political partner. And now, all the elites were against us, the political parties, the police, the whole state apparatus. And it's only because of his ownership of private property. You know, I mean, he confronted the state.
That's the only thing that kept him from being destroyed.
That's right. And he confronted the state, and he would tell them, listen, if you want to enter my property and take my property, you're going to have to kill me. And I mean, it got to that kind of level, you know. But yeah, that's what I realized.
That's the only thing protecting somebody like Alex Jones, you know, whatever you think of his views. It's the only thing that is protecting him from a complete obliteration.
Yeah.
Is the fact that he has gained some wealth through his enterprises.
That's right. And I think the left needs to appreciate how property enhances freedom and is not only a tool of oppression. Because
in fact, you know, I would go further and say this: the notion of exploitation is bullshit.
Right.
Okay. I mean, most this idea that labor, you know, first of all, the labor theory of value is specious, to put it mildly, and for various reasons. I think it's demonstrable that some value does not inhere in the object by virtue of any amount of labor deposited in it.
Yeah.
Value is basically determined by what someone's willing to pay for it.
Correct.
And this makes everything make sense. There's no more exceptions anymore that have to be accounted for by intellectual property. Everything that Marxists have to come up with, all the addendums and all the appendages to their main argument, you know, all these adjustments and, you know, ancillary axioms, are no longer necessary when you just realize that value is what people pay for it, that price and value are indistinguishable, and that the labor theory of value is nonsense. And, you know, without the labor theory of value, then, of course, the whole idea of exploitation falls to the ground. Because really, people aren't being exploited unless they're slaves.
I mean, I do agree that people are underpaid, and people
are underpaid.
Yeah, people, you know, so people could be underpaid. They could be, you know, treated in a very slave-like manner by their employers and all this sort of stuff. But I think that's an absence of property, right? Because when
when
the working class has no choice except to work for a capitalist, if you want to put it that way, to survive,
then
that's when exploitation happened. But if everybody had a piece of property, which happens in like tribal societies and collectivist society, so they don't have to work because they can go back to their tribal property. It may not be rich, but they're not compelled to work where there's a monopoly of oppressive employers.
The disparity between what the capitalist is able to sell a product for and what the laborer takes away from it is explicable in terms of the value that is placed on immediate rewards versus future rewards. I think this is what Mises points out very clearly.
Right.
And that is to say, the reason why you're willing to take less money today is because you're getting it today.
Yeah.
That's the capitalist is deferring their realization of their value to the future. And that's what they're paying you for something that isn't sold today, but you're getting paid today for what's going to be sold in the future.
That's right.
And the difference between what you get and what you produce is explicable in terms of the immediacy of its.
Right. Exactly. It's almost like a security discount or something.
Yeah, it's the same thing as why do you get charged interest when you borrow money?
Yeah.
The reason you're charged interest is because you're getting the money today. Yeah. As opposed to waiting for it in your paycheck or elsewhere I was getting it. So you pay interest because you're able to get something today that you wouldn't otherwise have today.
Yeah.
And it's an economic axiom that present tense value is greater than future tense value. I mean, it's a very simple idea.
Now, I want to return to the implications of your analysis in this thing, in this Google archipelago, because I think it's very important what we're touching on here. Because so we're seeing crony capitalism and state socialism as very similar. We're seeing the kind of a radical left and radical right individualist kind of freedom.
Individualists or individual.
Yeah.
Those who proffer or promote, I'm sorry, not proffer, but rather promote and hold to individual rights as supreme. Yes.
Yeah. So it can be similar. And then, you know, and so you have this weird thing of I don't know what we want to call that Hillary left, right?
Yes.
And that sort of...
Libertarian left.
Yeah.
The money left, you know, because... You know, I was asked once, what's the difference between these leftists here, you know, Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton leftists and your leftists who are basically, you know, marginalized or consider themselves subordinated or whatever. The difference is power, money.
Yeah, exactly. I
mean, that's the big difference.
Right. So, I mean, so Hillary Clinton was on The View the other day with Chelsea and they were talking about how, you know, they loved traveling with John McCain on, must have been Jeffrey Epstein's plane. I don't know. You know what I mean? But, you know, they love taking, you know. So they're all together. It's the uniparty. Yeah. It's what Pat Buchanan called the war party and all this kind of stuff. And then you have these left-wing people, you know, unfortunately, the term useful idiots just...
Yes.
I can't avoid it, right? So you have these people on the ground who are, you know, social justice warriors being paid for by Soros, defending corporations
denying free speech. And organizations like the NBA.
That's right, yeah.
Who are basically kowtowing to the most repressive regime, or at least the biggest repressive regime on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are putting people in concentration camps to this day.
Yeah.
And putting Muslims, and if you want to talk about Islamophobic, there's no greater Islamophobic state than the Chinese.
That's right.
Communist Party run state.
Because they're in bed with Saudi Arabia. They're in bed with China, right? So they're in bed with these people.
And they're ideologically akin. They are birds of a feather.
And so then they're funding all these SJWs who would maybe be aghast at that stuff. But then they have to make all these 1984 doublethink kind of things in their head to try to justify the contradiction.
They're ideologically in pretzels. They're pretzels. They're ideological pretzels, these people.
So they will now justify that Facebook has the right to shut you down because it's private
property. Yeah, they're fine with that. These people, this left, is just fine with deplatforming, with expunging individual rights of those who are on their opponents.
Which is the exact opposite, but it's the exact opposite of the civil rights struggle, because if they denied black people, rights to eat sandwiches on the counter.
Thank you for pointing that out. They're an anti-civil rights movement.
Yeah.
They are anti-civil rights. Now, it's the so-called dominant whose rights they would like to remove. But they're still anti-civil rights.
Correct.
In effect. I mean, fundamentally, right. They're anti-civil rights. Yeah.
You know, and so we have this weird alignment that's being masked by our inappropriate language, I would say, you know, but you're, you know, you're hitting on it in your book, right? But we don't have the language to describe what is going on, who are the enemies, who are, you know, and so as you said, with identity politics, the people who are against the war machine, who are against corporatism, who are against, you know, the all-powerful state are being divided, right? So the people on the progressive left, the radical left part, they're, you know, saying, oh, those guys are alt-right racists, nationalists. Yeah. And the people on the right are saying, oh, well, those guys are socialists and communists. And
yeah, so, then you have the battle within feminism of the so-called TERFs versus the, you know, the pro-trans feminists, you know.
That's right.
This is a very little known, by the way. Nobody on the right knows about this, okay,
right. Apparently,
is that the so-called trans-exclusionary radical feminists who object to the domination, in effect, a new form of patriarchal power in the form of transgenderism. These are people that are now getting men to take over women's spaces, women's sports, right. Women's colleges, women's scholarships, women's everything. People with penises are running feminism.
That's right. That's
Let me say this again. People with penises are running feminism.
That's right. It's insane. I'll tell you.
Oh, yes, but the penis doesn't mean anything.
That's right.
Sorry.
Has nothing to do with being a man.
It's not connected to chromosomes. It's not connected to hormones. It's not connected to genetics and genes and evolutionary history. It's not connected to anything. It's a free-floating signifier.
That's right.
Cut off at will. Yes, right. Cool.
Right, and the Google archipelago that you're talking about is enforcing this. So if you say this, I say this, then we are shut down.
That's right. We are deviating from the orthodoxy, and that is enough to get you depersoned or unpersoned. Yeah. Unpersoning is their main final. You know, it's to this point, we don't know how much further we'll go. I mean, they're already using digital fences in China in smart cities, which keep dissidents or others from certain activities. They can't go outside of certain perimeters. They're using it, of course, with the Muslims there who can't move at all. In some cases, they actually put Chinese people into their homes to surveil upon them. Did you know that?
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, to make sure they're not doing anything radical. Yeah.
So, and the digital fences are being erected around in the West as well, I think. They're starting to insinuate these digital fencing into, and what I'm getting at here, for example, the travel bans that have been put on so-called right-leaning people who can't enter countries now, like Gavin McGinnis, who can't enter, I think it's Australia, and Milo Yiannopoulos, who can't enter Australia, and Laura Loomer, who can't get into the UK.
And then even like Airbnb are denying these people, so they can't even travel within the country.
And banks are starting to consider, are actually starting to do, you know, throw people out of their accounts, abolishing their accounts based on their political views.
Yeah, and same with, and PayPal's been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, they're doing it, of course.
Right.
So this is an authoritarian leftist corporatism.
Yeah.
this is the right word, I think. Corporate doesn't necessarily mean capitalist. It's the main issue with corporatism, not the profit motive. It's the corporate nature of it. Corporate means collective.
That's right.
So these corporatists.
That's right.
There's their term. There's our term.
I think so.
If people can understand a denotation as opposed to a connotation, if people would understand that there's denotative language, you know, usage rather.
Yeah.
I'm using a corporatist in the denotative sense, and that is corporatist is about the body composed of a collective, you know.
Yeah.
That's really what they are. They're corporatists. Some of them are capitalists and some of them aren't.
Yeah.
Some of them believe themselves to be socialists, but they're actually bolstering the corporate capitalist agenda. I'd say people like Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and the whole Democratic Party that's now quote unquote socialist, they're just dupes. They're unwitting dupes, spreading an ideology that actually benefits these corporatists.
Yeah. And then what's amazing, so I think that's a great description and language we're developing for the political struggle. And then you're identifying how the central role that technology and big tech has in this by creating this matrix. And the way now I've seen you've talked about, and it's a brilliant insight and examples you use about how this is bleeding into real life too. Like Siri, you had this example of you said an inappropriate word to Siri, and Siri
I was chided out of the blue by an AI bot. Okay. And this was all going on at the same time that the social justice bots in my department were attacking me. So I thought, oh my God, this is really what put the two together in my mind. Yeah. That's why I wrote this book. I started, oh my God, they are the same. They're just different types of robots with the same ideology, and they're all coming at me together at the same time. I'm being chided by AI bots as I'm being attacked by so-called humanoid bots. They're all attacking me simultaneously.
That's right. No, and there's this alt-right meme that I think is very, very useful, right? I mean, people on the left.
NPC?
The NPC. You know, where you just down, because, you know, yesterday, al-Nusra is bad. Today, al-Nusra is good. Yesterday, Turkey is good. Today, Turkey is bad. So you have to get the new NPC download.
Yeah, right. And NPC meant non-playing character.
Yeah,
right?
Non-playing characters
in a gaming setting. They're a nondescript, absolutely neutral looking, absolutely
characterless character. And I think it's like you could talk to them in the game, and they'll have like maybe four or five things they'll say, and
over.
Yeah, first it sounds like you're talking to a real person, but later on you realize they're programmed to say the same things over and over, and it's not
just like thing. Just like this left, these leftists we're talking about, who exactly. On the internet, as I said in the book, I don't know if this was people you've seen, you apparently have read the book, and that's, I appreciate that. In the book, I say that these people in Twitter, the Twitter mobs, and all the Twitter mobs, and all that, they aren't technologies per se, but they may as well be. Because they act as predictably as any technology.
That's right, exactly. And so it's amazingly Baudrillardian.
Yes, I mean, isn't this crazy the way then we can take leftist notions? I don't know what to call Baudrillard. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Because they were against the communists, right?
They were actually post-communists. This is what people don't get.
That's right. Foucault was against Althusser and against the Communist Party. Yes, all these people. Right. Because everybody in the French Academy was a member of the Communist Party.
But I think Foucault's notion of panopticism is also invaluable in this context.
And governmentality, you use that.
Yes, Foucault, governmentality.
That the corporations are behaving...
as governmental. Yeah. Ancillaries or governmental apparatus.
Right, in a Foucauldian way.
Yeah. So all of that's there. So, I mean, it's... And yet... Maybe that's why the leftists, and it's, I don't know, it's not that bad yet, but I noticed that there's this contingent of leftists coming at me about this, trying to make my book look like it's some sort of conspiratorial nutcase nonsense, when it's very analytical, I think, you would agree. It's not, I'm not talking about conspiracies. Well, they may be conspiracies, but I have... They're well documented and well traced and well tracked and well supported arguments about certain types of collectivist ideas and behaviors.
Yeah, it's like maybe the idea of it's like digital corporatism. It's like digital corporate totalitarianism.
Digital collectivism, or as I call it in the book, digital Maoism. But I think if I called it digital corporatism or digital collective corporatism, that might actually cover the panoply of everything.
Yeah. I think people on the left. I think allies on the left would come on board and allies on the right. I really think, in thinking of politically of making an actual movement out of this, I think we need to get the dissident right and dissident left together, because we're actually fighting.
We're not that far from each other in many ways.
Yeah.
We have a common enemy. And they have declared themselves our enemy. We're not declaring them. They've declared us their enemy. So they are enemies by virtue of that.
But I think your book is really important in that sense. In advance.
If anything, it'll start a conversation, I hope, like the one we're having here. And exactly. I'm not saying it's the be all and end all of this conversation. It's a conversation starter, I think.
Yeah, because as you said in your preface, because reality is changing. So as you're writing it, new developments are happening. Because it was primarily, it could justifiably have been seen as a left attack on the right.
As
values on the left versus values on the right. But now we're seeing that it's corporatism.
It's corporatism and its different forms coming together in a kind of strange set of bedfellows, right? You have really people like Sanders and the types that follow him, in effect, bolstering the cause of the corporatist left.
That's right. And then what you have are real, I don't know if you want to call it, real dissidents, like Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah, I think she's a dissident for sure. Yeah. Definitely.
And she is not, and the system is coming down on her, right?
So, every dissident is crushed, or they try to crush them, yeah.
So she's reached pretty far for what she, but she's always, Putin's puppet, Russian asset, Assad's puppet. So every time they introduce her, they have to label her. It's.
Yeah, and they're saying that she's presenting Trumping and arguments within the Democratic Party setting, and they're condemning her for that.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah.
They're saying like she's like a Trump mole, amazing how both her and Andrew Yang are getting Trump supporters along with them. So we see there's this real on the ground movement of people on the left and right who are instinctively, they understand that Trump, Tulsi, Andrew Yang, there's something common in them, that the mainstream news network, that the university, the academia, the fake news, the fake academia will say that these people are opposite, but people are instinctively recognizing there's a battle that we don't have a language for yet, and that and all the identity politics and all that is separating us. All the left.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's being used as a huge lever.
Yeah.
They're just using identity types as power levers, right?
Yeah.
They just take these people and they effectively use them as wedges in order to drive through. And then, they're kind of, I don't know how to put it exactly. They take these identity types as a kind of, they're human hostages, if you will. They're human shields is really what
that's
they are.
That's right.
You take them as human shields and they use them to deflect away from their agenda. And they, so-called, they're supposedly, promoting the interests of these different identity categories. And they hide behind these identity categories while they push through.
And it's so much like the illegal immigration argument and stuff, because that is a program of cheap labor promoted by the corporations. And then they
they use this caring rhetoric, so people put on their front yards, hate is no home here, or something to the effect. I forget what one of the signs was basically saying, you know, everybody's welcome here or something. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, where are the immigrants on your front porch? Why are no tents pitched in your backyard?
Exactly.
But these people are actually unwitting dupes of the corporatists, who globalists, who want to have cheap labor and no restrictions on its movement.
Exactly. Now, you know, I know it's sometimes unfair to ask of analysts, you know, for solutions. You know, people, you know, try to do that and push you. And I do think it's unfair. I think the analysis is as important as a solution, because the right analysis implies your solution right there.
Yeah, right.
But from your analysis and the discussion, what do you think we can do actually to fight this?
Well, we have to produce, I say this in the book, we have to produce truth-based counter-narratives continuously. We have to keep countering the simulacrum or the simulation, which is trying to be fobbed off on us as reality. We have to continue to fight it with empirically sound, truth-based narrative.
Yeah.
That's the big, you know, overarching.
That's right. And you know what? That's such an important insight. It goes back to Orwell. Orwell said that was what distinguished all totalitarianism, the control of the truth. Erasing the past, erasing of the news.
Erasing past, changing language to describe things so that, you know, the ball's never, it's never clear what we're dealing with. Constantly controlling language, controlling usage. Changing the definitions of words, constantly producing assimilations of reality and false narratives as the official narratives.
That's right. And then changing that narrative at will, and we have to be able to keep up with whatever the arbitrary new ideology is today.
Yeah. So that's number one. And then, you know, in more specific cases, there are things we can do, I think, that should be done to combat the kind of partisan or differential or discriminatory really practices by virtue of mass class action lawsuits against big digital principles.
Yeah.
I think there has to be some class action lawsuits for discrimination. And especially since it's demonstrable that these organizations, in particular Google, since they were funded by the CIA Intel in the first place, they were funded by the CIA. Yeah. They are a state apparatus, and therefore they should not be allowed to be discriminatory as they are.
Yeah, yeah. It's like this old civil rights struggle. It really is.
Yes. Yeah. It's a civil rights struggle taking on a digital shroud.
Yeah. I mean, would you like to see the breakup of the companies or regulation?
I'm not going to argue for that, because I think it would be hypocritical of me, since I'm suggesting I'm not anti-capitalist.
Right.
I don't think we should punish success. We should not allow state-supported monopolization. And if we can show, through antitrust violation, mm-hmm. And I think that is important, but breaking things up just because they're big is not principled. It's not a principled stance. It's just rhetorically sounds good. It's the kind of garbage that people like Elizabeth Warren, mm-hmm. promulgate. It's garbage. The key, I think, is to have a principled stand against monopolies, against unfair advantages based on state support, state funding, and collusion between the state and these organizations, you know, because they're serving the state's surveillance functions so well, they get preferential treatment for doing so. They're ingratiating.
From a pure free market perspective, though, monopoly capitalism is the antithesis of...
Yes, that's right. So monopoly capitalism, or dirty capitalism, as the... Austrian school would refer to it.
Yeah.
Austrian school of economics. It's dirty capitalism has to be combated. And I would say, you know, really the true resistance is the resistance of this kind of collectivist bot behavior.
Yeah.
And to be truly human, we have to continue to
tell
the truth of the whole human, you know, the whole human saga, rather than these kind of, you know, plug and play rhetoric that is being used by this contingent, right?
Yeah, that's very important, right? To be truly human. You know, I think that's the underlying message of the kind of dystopian novels, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, 1984.
Yeah, that's right. It's the curtailment of human being.
Yeah, because the contradictory, imperfect human
is
the important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I preserve the individual as the key. The true minority is the individual. And I do believe that it sounds cliche, but everybody is absolutely unique.
Yeah.
Even twins, everybody, because of their experience is always different. So I believe in the absolute uniqueness of the person.
Yeah.
And that has to be protected. That's the true minority. And that has to be preserved above all else, because there are no rights other than that, than individual rights. And there are no humans other than individual humans. Everything else is a false abstraction produced by collectivist thinking.
Absolutely. Now, just to kind of follow up on the last discussion to round it off.
Yeah.
I know we have to go, but you know, how have you been forging ahead since, you know, you were, you know, attacked and effectively forced out of New York University, and so you've been attacked by this, you know, by the very machine you're describing.
Yeah.
The very corporate machine.
I'm forging ahead through my own writing and, you know, I don't know if you're referring to like my economic status or my
kind of, you know, like, I mean, I know you're doing things with Von Mises, right? And
yeah, stuff like I'm trying to, you know, produce a career out of my own resources and my own writing, but it's very difficult. I'm not struggling, but you know, I'm not in any dire situation, but, I probably need to get some sort of a media job, or another academic job in a non-discriminatory university, if there's any left.
Yeah, and that may have to be like a Christian university, or I don't know.
There's like, strangely enough, the most libertarian places now are Christian universities.
That's right.
I mean, I would probably have more liberty at Liberty University than anywhere else.
That's right.
Ironically enough, because, you know, they were supposedly the old cultural authoritarians was the religious right. Well, that's gone. I mean, anybody that's still living under that model of belief is just out of it. I mean, and I still run across some people like that. Yeah. They're wrong.
Isn't there it seems like there's a lesson there, isn't it? That like how the right was the kind of authoritarian.
Yeah.
And then now it's turned against the right, and the left became the authoritarian.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing it's turning against some people on the left. You know.
Yeah. What has to be turned against is authoritarianism itself.
That's right.
You know, and not left or right, but authoritarianism. You know.
That's right.
And that's what I've been trying to get across, is I never leave it open to just leftism per se. I think it's really authoritarian leftism is the enemy. As for me, you know, I would, you know, if there's anybody amongst your listeners that could endow a professorship for me so that I could actually do real research without being under the gun of, you know,
politically
correct torture and trammeling. Do so, please. But until then, I'll just soldier on.
Yeah. I sympathize with you. I know what it's like. You were talking about some of your plans. You're going to be working on a sequel.
Yes, I'm going to be working on a sequel with Zach Voorhees on a sequel to Google Archipelago, kind of more of a field manual as opposed to the, you know, the Google Archipelago is a theoretical and also a kind of a broad analytical argument. The next book that we're going to follow up with, it's going to be more like a field manual, and a compendium and an analysis of the whole terrain without getting into the politics of it in an overarching sense. I was trying to fit this Google Archipelago into a broad historical, you know, context. So I don't have to do that. I've done that one. Now it's time to do something more more like a field manual and a kind of a kit, you know, for, you know, for the real resistance. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Excellent. Well, I want to thank you very much, not only for the interview today, but really for all your work, for your determination, for your intelligence and insight and your persistence in the face of persecution. You know, you're really doing important work. I encourage everybody to get the Google Archipelago. Take, you know, it's important analysis of really what's going on and how we need to understand what's the real oppression that's going on in the society right now from corporatism. And yes. I wish you all the best and every success in your struggles ahead. Thanks for pushing the discussion
forward. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. We got into some very interesting stuff. It's not always that I do this and get to these places, and I really appreciate the opportunity. And thank you for being a great host.
Thanks. Well, that's all for Independent Thought and Freedom this week. Please join us again next week. And in the meanwhile, make sure you subscribe, leave me a rating, like, and share this podcast with your friends. Thanks, and bye for now.